today on Follow Our Lead. I continue the conversation with executive coach, leadership trainer, and culture consultant, Anna Welsh. With a decade-long tenure as a human resource executive, Anna knows what it takes to transform workplace cultures. In this episode, we talk about how leaders can improve their soft skills, develop self-awareness, support all members of their team, and create a psychologically safe office environment. Anna, it is so good to have you back on the Follow Our Lead podcast today for part two of your amazing session on leadership. So thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me back, and thank you to the audience for listening again. Once again, my goal is to deliver applicable tools, advice, and see if and how I can help business owners and organizations alike just elevate their game when it comes to culture.
Well, I think you've already done a fabulous job of that, but we're going to dive in even deeper than we did last time, which seems difficult to do because I feel like we touched on so many topics, but I know we didn't even scratch the surface. So How do you coach leaders to develop, inspire, and motivate their teams?
I have two tips. The one is very, very, very hard to follow, and the second one is a bit more actionable. The first tip is if you have a bad apple on your team, get rid of them. That bad apple is going to give the thickest barrier to developing, inspiring, motivating your team, because your team is going to be so distraught by this bad apple that they're going to be spending their time, quote unquote, venting about that bad apple. And it's going to really just get in the way of developing this really strong, productive culture. So that's the first tip, which I recognize is really hard. And most bad apples are very good at their jobs, hard skills wise. So I totally recognize, how hard that can feel to listen to saying, oh man, there's no way I can get rid of so-and-so. He's amazing. And he brings in X amount of revenue. Well, he's actually hurting your profit by destroying the culture in that team that he's interacting with. All right, let's talk about the second one, which is much more realistic and within reach. Build a leadership development program that's going to have a strong curriculum that's going to provoke deeper thought and performance throughout each session. Now, this leadership development curriculum or program can be done potentially by someone really strong within the organization, should they have the bandwidth and the desire to do so. You can kind of manually, quote unquote, do this yourself, but the best way to go about that is working with an expert, a professional that can help you develop the curriculum, help facilitate it, and really take all of the heavy lifting off of your plate. And all you need to do is put the dollars towards it and have the belief to make it happen. So, okay, you put together the leadership development program. What's next? Putting together an ongoing and, more importantly, effective one-on-one meeting rhythm and agenda. And the reason why I emphasize the word effective is most one-on-one meetings are whirlwind, day to day. What's going on? Did you do this? Did you do that? Hey, let's go to the follow-up. What's the action items done? It's very logistical in nature, which it should be. But the other portion of that one-on-one should be around the conceptual leadership development within that individual and really drive that two-way feedback conversation. Again, there's a lot you can do for low cost. And right now, many business owners and decision makers are starting to work on their budget process for next year. Put in a line item for that employee engagement. You have time to figure out how you're going to feed what the activity is going to be around that line item. But it's worth putting that line item in that P&L because it's eventually, and I can assure you of this, going to become a positive driver for your profits in that same exact P&L.
Okay, Anna, so many things to dissect from what you just said. All right, so my first question based on your response is, what happens if the bad apple is on the leadership team?
That happens often.
So, like, what do you do there?
Individuals that are aware of this bad apple, if they are being paid like a professional, they should be acting like a professional and speaking up. It's everyone's responsibility to contribute to the culture, not just leadership, not just managers. So if you have a survey that goes out, speak up about it. If you have an HR individual or team, go to them. If you have a good rapport with your boss or maybe even just someone else in the organization, have an effective conversation with them about how that bad apple is negatively impacting your team. But if you want to make a change, you have to take steps to make that change. And if it's on the leadership team, someone out there has to have the courage to start the conversation some way, somehow. Now, it's on a case-by-case basis. You may want to have that conversation directly with that individual. If you have a good rapport with them, that might be nerve-wracking to you. So you may have to go to different avenues. But do something, because not doing anything is going to drive in zero change.
Good advice there. Okay. So then you touched on a little bit about the leadership development curriculum. So what makes a good leadership development curriculum?
A buildup to incline on soft skills learned from the previous one, soft skills learned from the previous one, and anything that is tailored and applicable. I cannot stand generalities and warm and fluff and do this, do that. Okay. How are you going to do this? How are you going to do that? That is what every session should include, is applicable, actionable tips, resources, tools, advice to make a difference. A few examples. It could be psychological safety, communication 101, communication 201, delivering feedback, receiving feedback, driving self-awareness. There's so much around the soft skills that most people are not taught. They are expected to just learn and breathe that through the air because they're a really strong individual contributor. But as we know, not everyone is born with that innate skill set. So the more that we can deliver trainings and development resources and tools that are actually realistically applicable and tailored to the situation at hand, the more you're going to see an ROI come out of that curriculum, the training, taking them away from doing their jobs, the money that you have to put in to get that training lifted off the ground, the stronger the ROI will be.
The last part of what you said, though, was to get a really good meeting rhythm. So talk to us about maybe some tips we can take away to be better at running effective meetings and our own participation in those meetings. What will help move the conversation forward?
So first off, let's start with the basics before we go into making it effective. Have a meeting rhythm that is consistent, realistic in time duration, and that just happens. So many times I hear my clients say, oh, my boss just canceled my one-on-one. Or we had this team meeting, but there's this really time-sensitive project. We didn't end up having it. So just at the very least, be consistent in your meeting rhythm. A lot of times individuals are just talking through chat or email or whatever platform, Teams chat, Slack, but they're not actually sitting down without distractions and really thinking through a process. So make sure that your meeting rhythm is consistent, but also effective. How are you going to make a meeting effective? The agenda has to be a blend of allowing for dialogue as well as direction. Someone has to be super organized to take notes. More importantly, follow-up items. And then someone has to be super organized to bring those follow-up items back to hold everyone accountable in front of an audience. We would use who, what, when. That would be the follow-up items. Who's doing what? What are they doing? And when do they need to do it by? That's just a bare bones way to keep track of projects, change process, and whatnot. But at the very, very least, just be consistent. Put 10 minutes daily huddle, a half hour weekly team meeting, whatever it is that you need to do, and don't cancel it and just keep it. Start there.
So do you have a suggestion for how often people should meet? You know, we hear a lot of this, especially lately, like, oh my gosh, I was in this meeting and it should have been an email. How do we figure out how often we should have them so that they're productive?
Okay. So if you're talking about, there's two types of meetings I think of when you ask me this question. The first type of meeting is one-on-one development, professional development meeting, typically with a direct report and their supervisor, potentially even with the entire team, where people are talking through some maybe high-level items, but there's some soft skills development, conceptual conversation involved in that meeting. That, again, it depends. If it's one-on-one, every 2 weeks, every 3 weeks, maximum every 4 weeks. I think weekly is too much. Mm-hmm. Every 2 weeks for a half hour, an hour, I would recommend. Then we're talking about team meetings when it comes to like driving a process and making sure things are going and happening. Those are the meetings that I agree could probably be an email. Or if you're using something like Teams, you can create a Teams channel and you can create a project tracker, and you could do so much just in terms of tracking stuff in writing. But where I tend to disagree with that meeting could have been an email is if the meeting can deliver dialogue, open communication, brainstorming, and just elevating whatever it is, the topic at hand. If the meeting is just someone going through documents and regurgitating them or meeting them out loud, absolutely. Take it off your schedule. It's ridiculous. It's a waste of everyone's time. But to go back to your question, the frequency of it, if it's a one-on-one, I would recommend every 2 weeks, 30 minutes to an hour. If it's a team meeting, maybe every month for 1 hour. And if it's a project tracker, only have a meeting if it's going to engage dialogue and brainstorming and elevation of a process. When it comes to just doing logistical tracking, keep that in an email or some other type of resource or tool.
That's really good feedback. We're running into this situation where it was the pandemic. People were working remotely. Now people are coming back to the office. And now as they're coming back to the office, companies are frazzled because they're like, oh my gosh, we have to build culture. We have to build culture. And so they think that continuing to have these meetings that aren't really, it's like you have a meeting about the meeting and then you have a meeting and then, you know, it turns into like, this is not building culture at all. It's actually doing the opposite.
Always ask yourself when it comes to creating a meeting, is this an effective use of everyone's time? If it's not an effective use of everyone's time, cancel. Don't bother. Now, the other thing I'll say too is sure, everyone's coming back into the office and you want FaceTime and such. Guess what? You can also still do that virtually. If you need to talk through something, so many of us, myself included, so much easier to email or text, pick up the freaking phone and talk through it for 5 to 10 minutes. That you could probably get so much out of that versus a 1 hour meeting. So just balance the verbal and written communication, the hard skills and the soft skills in all of your communication, and ask yourself, is this an effective use of my time and my team's times, frankly?
Absolutely. And I think you also brought up a great point. I know for me, the way that I best think of ideas is through other people. So I need to talk to somebody, I need to talk through it. And then they'll say something, I'll be like, oh my gosh, that sparks something else. And then all of a sudden, all this creativity happens. And you lose that when it's all over email or Teams. I feel like you really need that face-to-face or even just over the phone time with people.
I couldn't agree more. There's nothing worse than a meeting where you don't speak.
Absolutely.
And there's nothing worse than a process gets executed poorly because you didn't have the time to brainstorm and put some more brains together to make it execute as best as possible.
A lot of times during meetings, there's not an opportunity for brainstorming. There needs to be something within the meeting that gets people engaged, excited, and lets the ideas start to flow. The meeting facilitator needs to have the skills to be able to do that.
The simplest way possible is if you're going to have a meeting, make it interactive. That's the simplest piece of advice I could give our audience. Make your meetings, group meetings, as interactive as you could possibly make it, and you're going to get a more successful outcome, and it's going to be an effective use of everyone's time.
What happens like the person that maybe is super quiet or that isn't very chatty? How do you get them to buy in and share their feedback?
Well, they have to feel comfortable speaking up, and that's a two-way street. They have to get the courage and the verbiage to share when they are ready to share. So that's on them. And the meeting facilitator and or their boss or just kind of their go-to, their alliance person in the meeting has to give them a platform to speak. And then after they speak, everyone in that meeting should want to drive psychological safety, which is making them feel comfortable, not making them feel stupid if they say something, and wanting to extract more information from all of the team members. Again, going back to make it as interactive as possible.
I love that. And I love this psychological safety. I've actually never heard that term before. I'm loving it. So can you talk to us a little bit more about psychological safety and how that may play a part in somebody's comfortability speaking to a group or just being engaged in their office?
So I've been talking about psychological safety since I learned about it. I want to say I learned about it around 2016, 2017. And it was derived from Google. They did a big, big study on all of their teams and all their teams' performances. I believe it was called the Aristotle Project or study. And they wanted to understand what made the highest performing teams so successful and effective in their outputs. And they realized it's because those teams that were the most successful had psychological safety, aka they all worked well together. There was no ego. They all were comfortable speaking up. They were all comfortable taking risks. They were all comfortable receiving and giving feedback. They all understood that they had to work well together versus as individuals in order to be successful. So psychological safety is something that, sure, it's a kind of coined term, if you will. But again, I go back to it's probably human nature and has been going on since the beginning of time. Lack of psychological safety and then a lot of psychological safety. So many times we're scared to speak up because we're scared we're going to say something stupid and then we end up second guessing ourselves. So we don't say anything. And then if we do speak up, there is a chance, depending on who's in that room, they're going to make you feel stupid, intentionally or not intentionally, or they're going to disagree with you. And then we're going to get kind of clammed up and not really know what to do thereafter. Then I'm like, screw it. I'm just going to stay safe and stay quiet. But psychological safety is all about empowering one another, making everyone feel comfortable and safe, and keeping your eye on the prize to succeed as a team versus as individual.
As soon as we get off this, I'm going to be Googling. I'm going to be getting some books. This is so exciting. I've never heard that term, but it makes so much sense. And I think it's so, so important to make sure that you have that. So very good information there. We have been talking about office culture in the accounting world in particular. We tend to have mergers and acquisitions because smaller companies, it's very difficult for them to survive with the cost of technology, the cost of CPAs, all of that. With that change, oftentimes creates fear among employees. What are your suggestions for leadership in times of change to help negate some of this fear?
This is something I have a vast experience, hands-on experience working through as a corporate executive in my former company. Most of our growth was via acquisitions. 80% of our growth was via acquisitions. We were a large dermatology group practice acquiring either one or multi-location. I would call it either mom and pop type practices or maybe a two or three location practice that was real tight-knit nevertheless. And I can't even begin to tell you how many times I would meet someone, be there in person, and they just have a look of fear. Like, just they're just so nervous that they're almost paralyzed by the events that are about to occur in front of them. And in addition to that, because we did so well wrapping our arms around the new team, if you will, around the individuals related to that acquisition, explaining that we want to grow big but still feel small, honoring their subculture, if you will, that they have spent years and years building, but then also illustrating the benefits of the change, acknowledging that it's going to be tough, it's going to suck, there's going to be days where it's going to be hard, but also inspiring them by saying, one day this is going to click to you like second nature, like the way your job was before. You're going to see all of the different benefits of joining a larger organization, and it's all going to work out in the end. What ended up happening is also some of those individuals had promotion opportunities that they wouldn't have ever had. They may have had stronger benefit packages that they didn't have. So really walking them through what to expect is key to motivating them to go through with this change. So first and foremost, acknowledging that change is really hard, but doing your best to take it one step at a time and just keep going. Easier said than done. Do you recognize that? Do your best. Do not surprise your end user, your audience member, that 30-year tenured staff member. Do your best to walk them through everything that they're going to expect and minimize surprises and acknowledge that it's going to be hard. Training and patience, teaching them new ways to do things in a proper setting, not on the fly with customers in front of you, really setting aside a dedicated space with uninterrupted time to train and have patience for them to learn is the other piece of advice. And lastly, have a maintenance plan that's going to include recognition, retraining opportunities, and emotional support when things get really frustrating.
When mergers and acquisitions happen, sometimes there isn't a dedicated person to lay out this type of a plan. When big mergers happen, that's really the key to the success of that company is going to be having somebody come in and just handle the employee piece of it, handle the culture and the actual merge and make sure that everybody is on the same page. I feel like companies don't do that. They should. But what happens if a company doesn't have a dedicated person? How do you recommend they implement something like this? And whose responsibility is it or should it be?
Frankly, the CEO. And if not, the CEO should be appointing someone else, or the head of HR. If not, the head of HR should be appointing someone else. But someone needs to be the warm and fuzzy, wrap your arms around the audience that will be undergoing the change. Someone needs to have most likely a PowerPoint to explain what to expect over the next 2 weeks, 30 days, 60 days, 90 days. What are the benefits of all of these changes? Really over-communicate, over-advertise how beneficial this change is going to be and what it's going to take to belly through the change. But I would say at the very least, one person needs to be dedicated to be the voice of change, the mama bear of change, the papa bear of change, and really be explicit about what to expect and what the benefits are going to be, the why. I would start with the CEO, start with the HR person. Maybe it's the head of ops, maybe the head of finance, but someone needs to do it and they need to make it happen because it's going to make a huge difference and minimize turnover, increase productivity, and frankly, minimize drama and headaches throughout the entire process.
Totally agree. So when we talk about, you know, effective policies and programs in relation to employee engagement, either during a merge or just in general, is there a specific program you've seen have really good success among your clients? Maybe some of that engagement program involves flexible schedules, or maybe it involves the reward system. What do you think has been, in your experience, the best avenue to go down in that regard?
Elena, I was thinking about this question. It's a very hard one to answer. And the reason being is I think a lot of things in our world as of today, July 6, 2023, is really ever-changing and the dust hasn't settled into this new way of the world. I think a lot of people are still trying to figure out remote, in-office, hybrid, Gen Z, millennials, boomers. I don't think anyone's really figured out this new way of managing teams and managing engagement. We kind of had it figured out back in 2019 and prior, but right now it's still ever changing. So what I will say about this is that it has to be based on the employee makeup. What is the socioeconomic makeup of a majority of your staff? Where is the highest turnover coming from? What are your staff asking for and saying when it comes to remote, hybrid, in office? A lot of times it's just the C-suite or leadership trying to figure it out up there, but they are the minorities in the organization. They most likely have more financial security. They most likely have more flexibility to come into the office with childcare and gas prices and things like that. So figure out either a committee that is full of kind of influencers, positive influencers within your organization, your HR team with key leaders from ops and business development or marketing, IT. Get really the core people that relate to and understand your majority of your employee population, and then build a engagement program that will be effective versus just kind of having C-suite sit at a beautiful boardroom and figure out what they think that $80,000 a year employee wants.
What are your suggestions for getting employees to speak up? I've issued employee engagement surveys, and when I first started doing them, people didn't want to respond because they thought that, you know, they weren't anonymous and so they weren't real in their feedback. And that's detrimental because, you know, you issue the survey because you want the feedback. Correct. So do you have suggestions about, number one, surveying, and two, just in general, how do you create an environment where people feel comfortable and give them the ability to share their thoughts?
That's a great question. First off, if you're not going to act on the results of the survey, do not deploy a survey. And that's going to start with leadership, because leadership may say, oh, I saw on like Harvard Business Review that we should be doing employee engagement surveys. So go do it. Someone has to have that tough conversation with leadership that's going to say, are you committed to making change based off of what our employees are saying based on the feedback of the survey? Oh, sure. Yeah. No, real change. Okay, let's try it. Let's see what happens. So that's number one. If you're not committed from top down to listen to the results of the survey and make actionable within reason, of course, within reason, everyone's going to say they're going to want more money. Everyone's going to say they want flexible schedules. Within reason, something to then say back to the employee, thank you so much for speaking up for us. We heard you. And here's what we're going to do. At the very least, acknowledge, but do your best at least tackle some of the low-hanging fruit. That's number one. Number two, if you are nervous about trust and whether it's anonymous, confidential, all that stuff, start small. Start with just ratings or a scaling question or a multiple choice, or just start small and minimize any open field. That will be an easier survey to complete for the end recipient and an easier survey to analyze for the high ups, the decision makers around it. But what I really recommend is doing your best to do stay surveys. What are stay surveys? Well, they are surveys that are one-on-one. They're supposed to extract information from that employee that is currently there, hasn't resigned. It's not an exit interview where they really share the tea after they leave. You want to get that information extracted from them while they're there and then make tailored changes to have them stay, hence it being called the stay survey. And you're like, okay, Anna, stay survey, that sounds great, but how do I even do this? You can actually get this lifted off the ground in a rather simple way. First, figure out who's going to maybe pilot it. Figure out who's going to start with these stay surveys. Doesn't have to be across the board. Maybe it's certain departments, or maybe it's certain reporting tiers. Then figure out the verbiage that everyone is going to use to introduce the stay surveys. That should be via a meeting, via a training where people role play. They feel really comfortable because it's something new and you're extracting really good information. You want to make them feel confident and comfortable doing so. So figure out that verbiage, make sure everyone's comfortable and on the same page. Then figure out three easy questions. Honestly, open-ended, easy. And start collecting the information obtained from those stay surveys. Consider conducting these stay surveys every quarter to start off with. It might take some time, but over the course of time, you're going to extract a lot of helpful information that maybe the employee didn't feel comfortable putting into some SurveyMonkey or form, and they felt comfortable sharing that with their direct report. And then you compile that. It might take longer, but you compile that real juicy pieces of information, data points, and then analyze it and deliver it to drive some change. So I think it's requires time, which you should be doing in your one-on-one anyway, but perhaps every quarter, ask them some real high-level insightful questions, collect it, and act on it.
It's so funny you talk about this, because I was at a conference last year, I believe it was. The seminar we were in was really about how to retain employees. And one of the biggest things that they suggested was take the time to do the stay interviews. Somebody asked a question there about what happens if the employee doesn't trust the person who's giving the survey. So how do we work around that? Now, one of the facilitators at the conference had said, pick two or three people in the organization who are going to have the same way of delivering the questions.
I do agree with that. And that's going to happen. And especially the larger, frankly, sometimes even the smaller, the organization, more tight-knit, that's going to happen. So I would recommend having the direct manager conduct the survey, the first day survey. If that manager identifies or thinks that that employee is not being reasonable, then identify who the better person would be to have conduct these state interviews. It might be a supervisor or a lead. It might be an HR individual, or it might be someone that employee feels more comfortable with, maybe even a former boss. But at my personal recommendation, I frankly don't think that there's like a perfect way to go about this, is start with the direct boss. The first conversation may not be as juicy as one may think, but at the very least, it's starting that trend of developing that two-way conversation to extract the information. They may feel more comfortable the second go-around, or they may feel more comfortable after they have the first official stay survey interview. After they realize, oh, she does care about me. She does want to know my information. A few weeks later, hey, I kind of thought about something that you asked me about, and I wanted to share a few more thoughts about it. At the very least, start with the direct manager because you want to at least start to build that foundation. If it really doesn't come to fruition and show that it's fruitful, then try an alternate approach. But again, if you just start with the direct report and the manager, if they're not vibing at the time, at the very least, the stay survey is a great tool to get them to just click a little bit more over time.
I think that's great. The other thing is on the flip side of that, somebody had raised their hand and said, well, my employees just want. And nothing I do satisfies them and they're never happy and they want more. What would you say in that respect, or how do we negate that from happening?
Man, this happens in so many companies. I can't even begin to tell you how many times I have heard this from kind of higher ups. In particular now with certain messaging that's out there on certain younger based social medias. I genuinely think that sometimes some people are just not going to be the best fit no matter what. They're always going to want, and they may end up just not being happy, and it's just going to kind of work itself out. That's not the ideal response to that, but sometimes that will happen. It is what it is. You're never going to satisfy everyone. But I have had so much experience with so many employees that want, ask, but they end up staying, even if they don't get what they want. Why? Because the manager does a really good job setting realistic expectations and playing that give and get kind of push and pull with that employee. Hey, unfortunately, we cannot give you that $3 an hour raise. What I'd love to do is figure out a more flexible schedule for you. Or perhaps you want to work in a different location. It may just be a matter of job fit. And there's so many different variables that play into the job fit. So what kind of, I don't want to say the word compromise, but what kind of compromise can you do? Because there is always a way. If you're managing and leading them correctly and effectively, they will stay even if they don't get 100% of what they want. But as I said earlier, sometimes they won't, and it is what it is. I have heard a term that sometimes I use. It has a little bit of sarcastic undertone, but it's actually very true to what could happen realistically. Let them flourish elsewhere. They're not going to flourish here. No matter what we try to do, set them free and let them flourish elsewhere. Mm-hmm. Not everyone's meant to be in that one spot that they're in for a long period of time. And that sucks. And that's what's going to happen. It is what it is.
I love that. I'm going to use that. I think that's fabulous. So thank you for that. Okay. So I'm going to take the conversation on a little bit of a different note because I know that you are a working mom. Yeah. So what suggestions do you have for female leaders who are struggling to manage their family and work? We're hearing this all the time now. Working moms are really struggling because they're having all these responsibilities at home and then they're going to work and they're trying to lead teams and deal with all the responsibilities there. And a lot of times employers don't necessarily create work environments that lend itself to the success of working moms.
I am a working mom. I have a 6-year-old son and a 3-year-old daughter. My son just finished kindergarten. My daughter is in preschool. When my son was born, I had a nanny for him, and I was very fortunate to be able to afford that. And that nanny, till this day, you know, almost 7 years later, is still close to our family. Whenever we go to New York City and we're near Hoboken where she lives, she'll come and babysit for us. She was really, I would not have been able to continue my job if it wasn't for her. Now, that leads me into childcare. Many times, working moms cannot either afford or find the proper childcare. I know there's so many impact makers out there that are working hard to change really a crisis that's going on in all of our communities, which is why so many moms, especially since COVID, have not returned to the workforce. There's a long wait list. Childcare business owners do not have it easy. There's tons of red tape, which for the most part, within reason, there should be. But there's not all these people building and creating and starting and opening childcare centers because it's really hard to maintain. So a lot of moms end up just staying home. Now, on the flip side, what happened to me when I had my son is literally my whole perspective on life changed. And there's so many friends, clients, people that I talk to that once they become a mom, their whole perspective changed. For me, what happened was I was no longer really that ambitious. I climbed the ladder, if you will. I was vice president for quite some time. When I had my son, I just wanted to relish in the fact that I created a life. I had my child. I wanted to be more present. I wanted to be the mom that was able to really put her phone down and enjoy my kid, go on vacations and not stress. And that really altered how I viewed work. I was able to kind of self-impose some boundaries without guilt because I knew my priority was no longer climbing the ladder. My priority was being a mom and a wife. And that helped me slow down a little bit. It also helped me, I think, be more patient with team members because I wasn't so like aggressive and go, go, go. And it really kind of changed my perspective on things. I, especially once I had my second, slowed down even more. I asked my CEO and boss at the time if I could scale back to 3 days a week. I did that for 2 years because that gave me a little bit of a breather. But I do know that for working moms, I don't have the perfect answer, but I do wish to share that if anyone's listening and they're a working mom and they feel overwhelmed, you are not alone. It's very, very overwhelming, in particular once your kids are really young and you're having more and more kids and you're in your childbearing ages. Just know you're not alone. Now, to your second part of your question for leaders and business owners and C-suites, when you have a working mom, don't penalize her for being a mom, whether you're doing it indirectly or directly. I mean, I have heard, I won't say names, but I have heard people say, well, she's a mom. You know, she's not going to be able to work as much. We may not want to hire her. Or, yeah, but you know what? She had so many PTO days and her kid's been sick so much. So she hasn't really performed. So she may not be eligible for that merit increase or that bonus. I am telling you, and from all of my experience, and again, I hate to generalize, but a large population of working moms, they are busting their butts. They're efficient, more efficient, I think, than a non-mom. Because we know we only have so many hours in the day and our brains multitask like champions and we will get work done in an efficient way. If we're valued, recognized, and people are being flexible and patient with us, we are loyal. But so many times they end up dropping out because they're like, screw this. I'm getting burnt on both ends. I'm not being a good mom because I'm putting so much into work and work's not appreciating me because I have to also be a mom. So be patient during the young kid phase of that working mom employee because that stickiness will most likely be there if you treat them with respect, recognition, flexibility, value. Once their kids get into grade school, things get quote unquote easier, which it really doesn't, but in a sense, it kind of does. The loyalty and that long-term performance and the built-in company knowledge and skill sets, it will pay off for sure. So big shout out to all the working moms. They are the bee's knees, in my opinion.
I totally agree with you. Is there any programs or anything in particular related to working moms that you think might be beneficial to implement in an office setting?
So a few things to answer that. But before I do that, I will be doing a major disservice as a sidebar here to also recognize stay-at-home moms. Because frankly, their jobs are harder than a working mom job because you are 24/7. You do not get a break. There have been so many times when my kids are really little, I'm like, oh my gosh, I'd so much rather be at work than home because it is mentally and physically exhausting. So I just want to make sure that I also recognize the stay-at-home moms out there. To answer your question, again, sadly, it's not a one-pronged approach. There's so many examples and ideas that I can come up with. Laura Mannion from the Chester County Chamber of Commerce has been on her soapbox for all of us working moms trying to make real legislative change. And one of the ideas that she shared was to have some sort of company discount for daycare centers. Maybe daycare centers earmark X amount of kids from BGANF that will be automatically enrolled once a year, whatever the case is. This is, I'm talking like, you know, magical, you know, process here, but it is possible to have some sort of core collaboration with local daycare or childcare centers, number one. Number two, even a working moms empowerment group where they are asked to meet, you know, every 30 minutes, once a month at the very minimal, and talk about a topic, share babysitters' phone numbers. Perhaps it's also providing childcare related classes for the working moms, how to potty train. There's so many local resources in particular here on the mainline area that are all about, you know, feeding therapists, speech therapists, things like that. What can you do to make the mom's lives easier would be what I would recommend just starting to brainstorm and think of. What can I do to make all of my working mom's lives easier?
Amazing feedback. And of course, Laura is the first person that came to my mind because she is really spearheading the charge to make sure that working moms are supported in the workplace and that this daycare crisis is addressed. So kudos to Laura. And I know she's going to be listening. So thank you, Laura, for all that you do.
Elena, one other kudos to Danielle Weisberg. She founded the Skim, and she also started a trend on LinkedIn about all of the help that she's able to get in order to be a co-founder and CEO. And she even started a hashtag, show us your childcare, so that other companies are out there showing what are they doing to provide support for working moms as well. So there's many Lauras and Danielles out there in the world. So anyone that's doing their best to make an impact, major thank you.
That's awesome. I did not know that. I love the Skim, but I did not know that. So now we might need to steal that for a future social media campaign.
Let's
so I
love that.
Thank you. I want to end it with, you know, new leaders. We didn't talk too much about them this time. We did on the last season, but could you give us a piece of advice, the best piece of advice you can think of for aspiring leaders or newer leaders? How can they up their game? How can they become successful in the workplace?
Twofold again.
Okay.
One, speed does not equal success. We all want to become that millionaire, the VP, and climb that ladder overnight. No, you can't do that if you don't have experience, if you don't take time to build relationships, time to think, time to learn, time to fail, time to grow. So speed does not equal success. Stop comparing yourself to others. Stop wishing you were already making this amount, that you already had this title. Embrace where you're at now and learn as much as you can now, because it will benefit you down the road, and it takes time. The second part is develop your self-awareness. I was an absolute idiot when I first started managing. I had zero self-awareness, but really high confidence, very low humility. And boy, did I wish I had stronger self-awareness via predictive index, a personality assessment that I also consult for, via a coach, someone that is going to have that real heart-to-heart conversation with me to open up my mind to more than what I'm just seeing with my blinders on. Take your blinders off, be humble, develop self-awareness in any way, shape, or form, because self-awareness will then build social awareness. And the number one thing I think that is a blessing and a curse in the workforce is if people don't like working with you because you don't have social awareness, you're not really going to succeed, at least not long term. But if you are the person that people like to work with, that they learn from, that they feel comfortable around because you have the self-awareness and the social awareness and that humility, you're golden for life.
When I first started managing a team, one of the difficult things for me, but I had the self-awareness, I just wasn't sure what to do with it. Like mm-hmm. I knew the areas I needed to improve on, but I didn't know how. And it was so great to have a coach to be able to give me the tools to say, hey, in this situation, why don't you think about it like this? Or why don't you look at it from their lens? Or maybe this is how they're seeing it, not the way you're seeing it. And for me, I think taking the personal aspect out of it was really, really difficult because I was taking all that home and thinking like, oh my God, like this person really hates me. Like they genuinely hate me. Maybe they do, but it doesn't matter. I'm there to be an advocate for the company, to be an advocate for the employees that work underneath me, and to make sure that everybody's being lifted up and supported and that our mission and our services are being relayed to the public in the way that they're supposed to be.
Many, many people are people pleasers. They will even tell you they're people pleasers. I just had a client literally today. I was asking her, what's at the root of your hesitation to discuss this with so-and-so? And she's like, oh, I'm a people pleaser. I'll tell you right now. I cannot stand someone not liking me or what I'm doing. And I hate to be this person to say this because I would hate when people would say this to me, but I do think that that starts to diminish with age a little bit. And the older you get, the more confident you get, and the more you just don't GAF what other people think. So forget that, right? We're still talking about young leaders who do care about what people think. And they have built their self-awareness now, but now they don't have resources and tools to develop as a leader. We all talk about books. There's a gazillion books out there for leadership development and everything like that. But who the frig has time to read books? I personally don't. So I recently developed, and sadly, this is not sponsored. I don't get any kickback from this. I wish I did. But I downloaded the Headway app. And you pay a small amount per month. And they basically, it's like cliff notes on books, really strong books. So you don't have to go through reading the whole book. You get not only the audio, so it's kind of like a podcast, but it's not a conversation. It's just sharing information. You get the audio, and you also in the app get the verbal, the written supplement to the audio too. For me, I like that. I retain that better. And just this Saturday, I listened to the cliff notes, if you will, the Headway of 13 things mentally strong people do. And it was so powerful. And while it's easier said than done, it surely goes into practice. A coach absolutely can help. A leadership development trainer, someone that can help you or something to give you those resources and tools to now be able to put that into action. What we talked about in the beginning of our call, generalities, warm and fuzzy are all great. It's all fluff. You need to understand what you can actually play into action. And there's resources out there that can help you do that. And as a small, low-hanging fruit, lower lift, I would recommend Headway app and figuring out what books may help you, leadership books there.
Oh, I'm going to have a really fun afternoon today.
I listened to Rich Dad, Poor Dad because it's just such a thick book. And I just, again, I have two small kids, you know, when I have free time, I'm drinking wine and relaxing or watching Bravo. Yes, so I don't want to read a really big book, but yeah, I learned so much in the 15-minute recap of that. And then the other things. And you can also, I did it, shameless plug, while I was getting a mani-pedi.
Amazing. Okay. This is great. All right, Anna, so many good tips. Thank you so much again
for an
amazing conversation. We appreciate everything. We're going to link everything about Anna and everything we talked about in this conversation in the notes. And Anna, we really appreciate it.
Elena, thank you. And to anyone listening, if you want to talk further about if and how I might be able to help you, go to annawelsh.com, annawelsh.com. Right there is a link to schedule a complimentary call. We can talk through it. If I'm not the right person to help you, I can refer you. Otherwise, I might be able to even just give you a few tips right then and there. But I'd love to meet with anyone who listened to this and resonated with this and wanted to talk further.
Awesome. Thank you. From conducting stay interviews to holding more effective meetings to psychological safety training, Anna shares actionable steps leaders can take to make real change in their company cultures. A great company culture makes for loyal employees, less turnover, and increased ROI. Anna also shares her experience as a working mom and how business owners can best support all members of their teams. To learn more about how Anna's services can help take your business to the next level, we'll provide a link in the description notes. Until next time.